Rafiq al-Shabazz had settled such questions to his own satisfaction. I had first met Rafiq while working with some of my leaders on setting up a job training center to serve the South Side's unemployed. He was a slight, wiry man with a goatee and a skullcap that accentuated a pair of prominent ears, a former gangbanger who had formed an organization called the Roseland Unity Coalition. The purported purpose of the organization was black empowerment and economic development. According to Rafiq, the coalition had been critical to helping Mayor Washington get elected. From what my leaders told me, however, Rafiq spent most of his time intimidating local businesses and elected officials into giving him small contracts for, quote, community outreach and other vaguely defined ventures. In fact, it was after we negotiated with the city of Chicago to open up a new job training center in the area that Rafiq called me up and launched into a rapid-fire monologue. "We got to talk, Barack," he said. "What y'all trying to do with the job training needs to fit into the overall comprehensive development plan I've been working on. Can't think about this thing in isolation. Got to look at the big picture. You don't understand the forces at work out here. It's big, man. All kinds of folks ready to stab you in the back." I eventually gathered that Rafiq had an interest in having the new training center we just proposed to the city locate in a certain building near his office on Michigan Avenue. I didn't ask the particular nature of that interest. I doubted I could get a straight answer out of him. And anyway, I figured that we might be able to use Rafiq as an ally in what was proving to be a series of sticky negotiations with the city. If the storefront he had in mind met the necessary specifications, I said, then I was willing to propose it as one possible alternative. So Rafiq and I formed an uneasy alliance, one that didn't go over too well with the DCP leaders. I understood their concerns. Whenever we sat down with Rafiq to discuss our joint strategy, he would interrupt the discussion with long lectures about secret machinations afoot and all the black people willing to sell folks down the river. It was an effective negotiating ploy, for with his voice progressively rising, the veins in his neck straining, leaders like Ruby would suddenly drop into a curious silence, watching Rafiq as if he were an epileptic in the midst of a seizure. More than once, I'd have to jump in and start shouting back at him, not so much in anger as simply to slow him down, until finally a small smile would curl under his mustache, and we could get back to work. When the two of us were alone, though, Rafiq and I could sometimes have normal conversations. Over time, I arrived at a grudging admiration for his tenacity and bravado, and, within his own terms, a certain sincerity. He confirmed that he had been a gang leader growing up in the Augel Gardens public housing projects. He had found religion, he said, under the stewardship of a local Muslim leader, unaffiliated with Minister Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. "If it hadn't been for Islam, man, I'd probably be dead," he told me one day. "Just had a negative attitude, you understand? Growing up in Augeld, I'd soak up all the poison the white man feeds us. See, the folks you're working with got the same problem, even though they don't realize it yet. They spend half their lives worrying about what white folks think. Start blaming themselves for the shit they see every day, thinking they can't do no better till the white man decides they all right. But deep down, they know that ain't right. They know what this country has done to their mama, their daddy, their sister. So the truth is they hate white folk, but they can't admit it to themselves. Keep it all bottled up, fighting themselves. Waste a lot of energy that way. I tell you one thing I admire about white folks," Rafiq continued. "They know who they are. Look at the Italians. They didn't care about the American flag and all that when they got here. First thing they did was put together the mafia to make sure their interests were met. The Irish, they took over the city hall, found their boys some jobs. The Jews, same thing. You telling me they care more about some black kid on the South Side than they do about relatives in Israel? Shit. It's about blood, Barack. Looking after your own. Period. Black people the only ones stupid enough to worry about their enemies." That was the truth as Rafiq saw it, and he didn't waste energy picking that truth apart. His was a Hobbesian world where distrust was a given and loyalties extended from family to mosque to the black race, whereupon notions of loyalty ceased to apply. This narrowing vision of blood and tribe had provided Rafiq with a clarity of sorts, a means of focusing his attention. Black self-respect had delivered the mayor's seat, he could argue, just as black self-respect turned around the lives of drug addicts under the tutelage of the Muslims. Progress was within our grasp so long as we didn't betray ourselves. But what exactly constituted betrayal? Ever since the first time I'd picked up Malcolm X's autobiography, I tried to untangle the twin strands of black nationalism, arguing that nationalism's affirming message of solidarity and self-reliance discipline, and communal responsibility need not depend on hatred of whites any more than it depended on white munificence. We could tell this country where it was wrong, I would tell myself and any black friends who would listen, without ceasing to believe in its capacity for change. In talking to self-professed nationalists like Rafiq, though, I came to see how the blanket indictment of everything white served a central function in their message of uplift, how psychologically, at least, one depended on the other. For when the nationalist spoke of a reawakening of values as the only solution to black poverty, he was expressing an implicit, if not explicit, criticism to black listeners, that we did not have to live as we did. And while there were those who could take such an unadorned message and use it to hew out a new life for themselves, those with the stolid dispositions that Booker T. Washington had once demanded from his followers, in the ears of many blacks, such talk smacked of the explanations that whites had always offered for black poverty, that we continued to suffer from, if not genetic inferiority, then cultural weakness. It was a message that ignored causality or fault, a message outside history, without a script or plot that might insist on progression. For a people already stripped of their history, a people often ill-equipped to retrieve that history in any form other than what fluttered across the television screen, the testimony of what we saw every day seemed only to confirm our worst suspicions about ourselves. Black nationalism provided that history, an unambiguous morality tale that was easily communicated and easily grasped. A steady attack on the white race, the constant recitation of black people's brutal experience in this country, served as the ballast that could prevent the ideas of personal and communal responsibility from tipping into an ocean of despair. Yes, the nationalists would say, whites are responsible for your sorry state, not any inherent flaws in you. In fact, the nationalists would continue, whites are so heartless and devious that we can no longer expect anything from them. The self-loathing you feel, what keeps you drinking or thieving, is planted by them. Rid them from your mind and find your true power liberated. Rise up, ye mighty race. All this was painful to consider, as painful now as it had been years ago. It contradicted the morality my mother had taught me, a morality of subtle distinctions, between individuals of goodwill and those who wished me ill, between active malice and ignorance or indifference. I had a personal stake in that moral framework. I discovered that I couldn't escape it if I tried. As it turned out, though, it was questions of effectiveness and not sentiment that caused most of my quarrels with Rafiq. Once, after a particularly thorny meeting with the city, I asked Rafiq whether he could turn out his followers if a public showdown with the city became necessary. I don't got time to run around passing out flyers trying to explain everything to the public, Rafiq said. Most of the folks out here don't care one way or another. The ones that do are going to be double-crossing Negroes trying to mess things up. Important thing is to get our plan tight and get the city signed on. That's how stuff gets done, not with a big crowd and noise and all that. Once we get a done deal, then y'all announce it any way you like. I disagreed with Rafiq's approach. For all his professed love of black people, he seemed to distrust them an awful lot. But I also knew his approach was dictated by a lack of capacity. Neither his organization nor his mosque, I had discovered, could claim a membership of more than 50 persons. His influence arose not from any strong organizational support, but from his willingness to show up at every meeting that remotely affected Roseland and shout his opponents into submission. What held true for Rafiq was true throughout the city, without the concentrating effect of Harold Washington's campaign. Nationalism dissipated into an attitude rather than any concrete program, a collection of grievances and not an organized force, images and sound that crowded the airwaves and conversation, but without any corporal existence. Among the handful of groups to hoist the nationalist banner, only the Nation of Islam had any significant following. Minister Farrakhan's sharply cadenced sermons generally drew a packed house, and still more listened to his radio broadcasts. But the nation's active membership in Chicago was considerably smaller. Several thousand, perhaps, roughly the size of one of Chicago's biggest black congregations. A base that was rarely, if ever, mobilized around political races or in support of broad-based programs. In fact, the physical presence of the nation in the neighborhoods was nominal, restricted mainly to the clean-cut men in suits and bow ties who stood at the intersections of major thoroughfares selling the nation's newspaper, The Final Call. Questions of competition, decisions forced by a market economy and majoritarian rule, issues of power. It was this unyielding reality, that whites were not simply phantoms to be expunged from our dreams, but were an active and varied fact of our everyday lives, that finally explained how nationalism could thrive as an emotion and flounder as a program. So long as nationalism remained a cathartic curse on the white race, it could win the applause of the jobless teenager listening on the radio or the businessman watching late-night TV. But the descent from such unifying fervor to the practical choices blacks confronted every day was steep. Compromises were everywhere. The black accountant asked, "How am I going to open an account at the black-owned bank if it charges me extra for checking and won't even give me a business loan because it says it can't afford the risk?" The black nurse said, "White folks I work with ain't so bad, and even if they were, I can't be quitting my job. Who's going to pay my rent tomorrow or feed my children today?" Rafiq had no ready answers to such questions. He was less interested in changing the rules of power than in the color of those who had it, and therefore enjoyed its spoils. There was never much room at the top of the pyramid. In a contest framed in such terms, the wait for black deliverance would be long indeed. What in the hands of Malcolm X had once seemed a call to arms, a declaration that we would no longer tolerate the intolerable, came to be the very thing Malcolm had sought to root out. One more feeder of fantasy, one more mask for hypocrisy, one more excuse for inaction. Black politicians less gifted than Harold discovered what white politicians had known for a very long time, that race baiting could make up for a host of limitations. Younger leaders, eager to make a name for themselves, upped the ante, peddling conspiracy theories all over town. The Koreans were funding the Klan, Jewish doctors were injecting black babies with the AIDS virus. It was a shortcut to fame, if not always fortune. Like sex or violence on TV, black rage always found a ready market. Nobody I spoke with in the neighborhood seemed to take such talk very seriously. As it was, many had already given up the hope that politics could actually improve their lives, much less make demands on them. To them, a ballot, if cast at all, was simply a ticket to a good show. Blacks had no real power to act on the occasional slips into anti-Semitism or Asian bashing, people would tell me. And anyway, black folks needed a chance to let off a little steam every once in a while. "Man, what do you think those folks say about us behind our backs?" Just talk. Yet what concerned me wasn't just the damage loose talk caused our efforts at coalition building, or the emotional pain it caused others. It was the distance between our talk and our action, the effect it was having on us as individuals and as a people. That gap corrupted both language and thought. It made us forgetful and encouraged fabrication. It eventually eroded our ability to hold either ourselves or each other accountable. The continuing struggle to align word and action, our heartfelt desires with a workable plan, didn't self-esteem finally depend on just this? It was that belief which had led me into organizing, and it was that belief which would lead me to conclude, perhaps for the final time, that notions of purity, of race, or of culture could no more serve as the basis for the typical black American self-esteem than it could for mine. Our sense of wholeness would have to arise from something more fine than the bloodlines we inherited. It would have to come from the messy, contradictory details of our own experience. I pulled into the airport parking lot at 3:15 and ran to the terminal as fast as I could. I looked down at the photograph in my hand, the one Alma had sent me 2 months earlier, smudged now from too much handling. Then I looked up, and the picture came to life. An African woman emerging from behind the customs gate, moving with easy, graceful steps, her bright, searching eyes now fixed on my own, her dark, round, sculpted face blossoming like a wood rose as she smiled. "Barak! Alma!" I lifted my sister off the ground as we embraced, and we laughed and laughed as we looked at each other. I picked up her bag and we began to walk to the parking garage, and she slipped her arm through mine. And I knew at that moment, somehow, that I loved her, so naturally, so easily and fiercely, that later, after she was gone, I would find myself mistrusting that love, trying to explain it to myself. "So, brother," Alma said as we drove into the city, "you have to tell me everything." I told her about Chicago and New York, my work as an organizer, my mother and grandparents and my other sister, Maya. She had heard so much about them from our father, she said. She felt as if she already knew them. She described Heidelberg, where she was trying to finish a master's degree in linguistics, and the trials and tribulations of living in Germany. "I have no right to complain, I suppose," she said. "I have a scholarship, a flat. I don't know what I would be doing if I was still in Kenya. Still, I don't care for Germany so much. You know, the Germans like to think of themselves as very liberal when it comes to Africans. But if you scratch the surface, you see they still have the attitudes of their childhood. In German fairy tales, black people are always the goblins. Such things one doesn't forget so easily. Sometimes I try to imagine what it must have been like for the old man leaving home for the first time." Alma and I spent the day together, visiting the Art Institute, digging old photos out of my closet, and visiting the supermarket. We didn't speak much about our father, though. It was as if our conversation stopped whenever we threatened to skirt his memory. It was only that night, after dinner and a long walk along the lake's crumbling breakwall, that we both sensed we couldn't go any further until we opened up the subject. I made us some tea, and Alma began to tell me about the old man, at least what she could remember. "I can't say I really knew him, Barak," she began. "Maybe nobody did. Not really. His life was so scattered. People only knew scraps and pieces, even his own children. I was scared of him. You know, he was already away when I was born, in Hawaii, with your mom, and then at Harvard. When he came back to Kenya, our oldest brother, Roy, and I were small children. We had lived with our mom in the country, in Alego up until then. I just remember that he came back with an American woman, named Ruth, and that he took us from our mother to go live with them in Nairobi. I remember that this woman, Ruth, was the first white person I'd ever been near, and that suddenly she was supposed to be my new mom. In those first years, the old man was doing really well, you see. He was working for an American oil company, Shell Oil, I think. It was only a few years after independence, and the old man was well connected with all the top government people. The vice president, ministers, they would all come to the house sometimes and drink with him and talk about politics. He had a big house and a big car, and everybody was impressed with him because he was so young, but he already had so much education from abroad. Ruth, our new mother, was nice enough to us then. She treated us almost like her own children. Then things began to change. When Ruth gave birth to our other brothers, Mark and David, her attention shifted to them. The old man, he left the American company to work in the government for the Ministry of Tourism. He may have had political ambitions, and at first he was doing well in the government. But in 1966 or 67, the divisions in Kenya had become more serious. President Kenyatta was from the largest tribe, the Kikuyus. The Luos, the second largest tribe, began to complain that Kikuyus were getting all the best jobs. The vice president, Ondinga, was a Luo, and he said the government was becoming corrupt. Then instead of serving those who had fought for independence, Kenyan politicians had taken the place of the white colonials, buying up businesses and lands that should be redistributed to all the people. A popular Luo minister, Tom Mamboya, was killed by a Kikuyu gunman. Luos began to protest in the streets, and the government police cracked down. People were killed. Most of the old man's friends just kept quiet and learned to live with the situation. But the old man began to speak up. He would tell people that tribalism was going to ruin the country, and that unqualified men were taking the best jobs. His friends tried to warn him about saying such things in public, but he didn't care. He always thought he knew what was best, you see. When he was passed up for a promotion, he complained loudly. Word got back to Kenyatta that the old man was a troublemaker, and he was called in to see the president. According to the stories, Kenyatta said to the old man that because he could not keep his mouth shut, he would not work again until he had no shoes on his feet. I don't know how much of these details are true, but I know that with the president as an enemy, things became very bad for the old man. He was banished from government, blacklisted. None of the ministers would give him work. Finally, he had to accept a small job with the water department. The job kept food on the table, but it was a big fall for him. The old man began to drink heavily, and many of the people he knew stopped coming to visit because now it was dangerous to be seen with him. I understood most of this only when I was older. At the time, I just saw that life at home became very difficult. The old man never spoke to Roy or myself except to scold us. He would come home very late, drunk, and we could hear him shouting at Ruth, telling her to cook him food. Roy and I began to feel like we had no one. And when Ruth left the old man, That feeling was not so far from the truth. Ruth left when I was 12 or 13, after the old man had a serious car accident. For a long time, the old man was in the hospital, almost a year, and Roy and I basically lived on our own. Because of the accident, the old man had now lost his job at the water department, and we had no place to live. Then we found a rundown house in a rough section of town, and we stayed there for several years. That was a terrible time. The old man had so little money, he would have to borrow from relatives just for food. This made him more ashamed, I think, and his temper got worse. Despite all our troubles, he would never admit to Roy or myself that anything was wrong. I think that's what hurt the most, the way he would still put on airs about how we were the children of Dr. Obama. Roy and him would have terrific fights. Finally, Roy just left. He just stopped coming home and started living with different people. So I was left alone with the old man. Sometimes I would stay up half the night, waiting to hear him come through the door, worrying that something terrible had happened. Then he would stagger in drunk and come into my room and wake me because he wanted company or something to eat. He would talk about how unhappy he was and how he had been betrayed. Secretly, I began to wish that he would just stay out one night and never come back. In my last 2 years of high school, the old man's situation improved. Kenyatta died, and somehow the old man was able to work again in government. He got a job with the Ministry of Finance and started to have money again and influence. But I think he never got over the bitterness of what had happened to him, seeing his other age mates, who had been more politically astute, rise ahead of him. And it was too late to pick up the pieces of his family. For a long time, he lived alone, in a hotel room, even when he could afford again to buy a house. I almost never saw him, and when I did, he didn't know how to behave with me. We were like strangers. But you know, he still wanted to pretend that he was a model father and could tell me how to behave. I remember when I got my scholarship to study in Germany, I was afraid to tell him. I thought he might say I was too young to go and interfere with my student visa, which had to be approved by the government. So I just left without saying goodbye. For some time, Alma had been staring at our father's photograph, soft-focused in the dim light. Now she stood up and went to the window, her back turned to me. "You know, the old man used to talk about you so much," Alma said. "He would show off your picture to everybody and tell us how well you were doing in school. I guess your mom and him used to exchange letters. I think those letters really comforted him. During the really bad times, when everybody seemed to have turned against him, he would bring her letters into my room and start reading them out loud. He would wake me up and make me listen. And when he was finished, he would shake the letter in his hand and say how kind your mom had been. 'You see,' he would say, 'at least there are people who truly care for me.' He'd say this to himself over and over again." While Alma brushed her teeth, I prepared the convertible sofa for her. Soon she was curled up under a blanket, sound asleep. But I remained awake, propped up in a chair with the desk light on, looking at the stillness of her face, listening to the rhythm of her breathing, trying to make some sense out of all that she had said. I felt as if my world had been turned on its head, as if I had woken up to find a blue sun in a yellow sky, or heard animals speaking like men. All my life I had carried a single image of my father, one that I had sometimes rebelled against but had never questioned, one that I had later tried to take as my own. The brilliant scholar, the generous friend, the upstanding leader. My father had been all those things. Now, as I sat in the glow of a single light bulb, rocking slightly on a hardback chair, that image had suddenly vanished. Replaced by what? A bitter drunk? A defeated, lonely bureaucrat? To think that all my life I had been wrestling with nothing more than a ghost. For a moment I felt giddy. If Alma hadn't been in the room, I probably would have laughed out loud. The king is overthrown, I thought. The emerald curtain is pulled aside. The rabble in my head is free to run riot. I can do whatever I damn well please. For what man, if not my own father, has the power to tell me otherwise? Whatever I do, it seems, I won't do much worse than he did. As the night wore on, I tried to regain my balance, sensing that there was little satisfaction to be had for my newfound liberation. The fantasy of my father had at least kept me from despair. Now he was dead. Truly. He could no longer tell me how to live. All he could tell me, perhaps, was what had happened to him. It occurred to me that for all the new information, I still didn't know the man my father had been. What had happened to all his vigor, his promise? What had shaped his ambitions? I imagined once again the first and only time we'd met. The man I now knew must have been as apprehensive as I was. The man who had returned to Hawaii to sift through his past and perhaps try and reclaim that best part of him, that part that had been misplaced. He hadn't been able to tell me his true feelings then, any more than I had been able to express my 10-year-old desires. We had been frozen by the sight of the other, unable to escape the suspicion that under examination, our true selves would be found wanting. Now, 15 years later, I looked into Alma's sleeping face and saw the price we had paid for that silence. 10 days later, Alma and I sat in the hard plastic seats of an airport terminal, looking out at the planes through a high wall of glass. I asked her what she was thinking about, and she smiled softly. "I was thinking about Alego," she said. "Home Square. Our grandfather's land. Where Granny still lives. It's the most beautiful place, Barak. When I'm in Germany, and it's cold outside, and I'm feeling lonely, I sometimes close my eyes and imagine I'm there, sitting in the compound, surrounded by big trees that our grandfather planted. Granny is talking, telling me something funny, and I can hear the cow swishing its tail behind us, and the chickens pecking at the edges of the field, and the smell of the fire from the cooking hut. And under the mango tree, near the cornfields, is the place where the old man is buried." Alma's flight was starting to board. We remained seated, and Alma closed her eyes, squeezing my hand. "We need to go home," she said. "We need to go home, Barak, and see him there." Johnny Owens and I were walking back to the car after dinner in Hyde Park, and Johnny was in an expansive mood. He often got like this, especially after a good meal and wine. The first time I met him, when he was still working with the Downtown Civic Group, he had started to explain the relationship between jazz and Eastern religion, then swerved into an analysis of black women's behinds, before coming to a stop on the subject of Federal Reserve Bank policy. In such moments, Johnny's eyes would grow wide, his voice would speed up, his round, bearded face would glow with a childlike wonder. That was part of the reason I'd hired Johnny, I suppose, that curiosity of his appreciation of the absurd. He was a philosopher of the blues. We'd almost reached Johnny's car when we heard a small pop, compact and brief, like a balloon bursting. We looked in the direction of the sound and watched a young man appear from around the corner diagonal to us. I don't clearly recall his features or what he wore, although he couldn't have been older than 15. I just remember that he ran at a desperate pace, his sneakered feet silent against the sidewalk, his lanky limbs pumping wildly, his chest jutting out as if straining for an imaginary tape. Johnny dropped flat onto a small plot of grass in front of one of the apartments, and I quickly followed suit. A few seconds later, two more boys came around the same corner, also running at full speed. One of them, short, fattish, with pants that bunched around his ankles, was waving a small pistol. Without stopping to aim, he let out three quick shots in the direction of the first boy. Then, realizing that his target was out of range, he slowed to a walk, stuffing the weapon under his shirt. His companion, skinny and big-eared, came alongside. "Stupid motherfucker," the skinny boy said. He spat with satisfaction, and the two of them laughed to each other before continuing down the street. Children again, their figures casting squat shadows on the asphalt. I had been in Chicago for over 2 years by this time. The organization had grown, and I had grown with it. Marty had moved on, deciding to try his hand working in a less hostile atmosphere. Working on my own, I had recruited new churches, found new leaders, helped to build new playgrounds and remove asbestos from a local housing project, and expand our job training efforts. Johnny's presence as my deputy had helped relieve my workload, and our budget was stable. What I'd lost in youthful enthusiasm, I made up for in experience. And in fact, it may have been that growing familiarity with the landscape, the council of time, that gave me the sense that something different was going on with the children of the South Side that spring of 1987, that a line had been crossed, a blind and ugly corner turned. There was nothing definite I could point to, no hard statistics. The drive-by shootings, the ambulance sirens, the night sounds of neighborhoods abandoned to drugs and gang war, and phantom automobiles, where police or press rarely ventured until after the body was found on the pavement, blood spreading in a glistening, uneven pool. None of this was new. In the housing projects, prison records had been passed down from father to son for more than a generation. During my very first days in Chicago, I had seen the knots of young men, 15 or 16, hanging out on the corners of Michigan or Halsted, their hoods up, their sneakers unlaced, stomping the ground in a desultory rhythm during the colder months, stripped down to t-shirts in the summer, answering their beepers on the corner payphones, a knot that unraveled, soon to reform, whenever the police cars passed by in their barracuda silence. No, it was more of a change of atmosphere, like the electricity of an approaching storm. I felt it when, driving home one evening, I saw four tall boys walking down a tree-lined block, idly snapping a row of young saplings that an older couple had just finished planting in front of their house. I felt it whenever I looked into the eyes of the young men in wheelchairs who had started appearing on the streets that spring, boys crippled before their prime, their eyes without a trace of self-pity, eyes so composed, already so hardened, that they served to frighten rather than to inspire. That's what was new. The arrival of a new equilibrium between hope and fear. The sense, shared by adults and youth alike, that some, if not most of our boys, were slipping beyond rescue. Even lifelong Southsiders, like Johnny, noticed the change. "I ain't never seen it like this, Barack," he would tell me one day as we sat in his apartment sipping beer. "I mean, things were tough when I was coming up, but there were limits. We'd get high, get into fights, but out in public, at home, if an adult saw you getting loud or wild, they'd say something, and most of us would listen. You know what I'm saying? Now, with the drugs, the guns, all that's disappeared. Don't take a whole lot of kids carrying a gun. Just one or two. Somebody says something to one of them, and pow, kid wastes them. Folks hear stories like that, they just stop trying to talk to young cats out here. We start generalizing about them, just like the white folks do. We see them hanging out, we head the other way. After a while, even the good kid starts realizing, ain't nobody out here going to look out for him. So he figures he's going to have to look out for himself. Bottom line, you've got 12-year-olds making their own damn rules." Johnny took another sip of his beer. "I don't know, Barack. Sometimes I'm afraid of him. You've got to be afraid of somebody who just doesn't care. Don't matter how young they are." After I was back in my own apartment, I thought about what Johnny had said. Was I afraid? I didn't think so. At least not in the way that Johnny had meant it. Wandering through tough neighborhoods, my fears were always internal, the old fears of not belonging. The idea of physical assault just never occurred to me. Same thing with the distinction Johnny had made between good kids and bad kids. The distinction didn't compute in my head. It seemed based on a premise that defied my experience, an assumption that children could somehow set the terms of their own development. I thought about the little boys that I often saw, scampering around the South Side's broken roads. Where did they sit along the spectrum of goodness? If they ended up in a gang or in jail, would that prove their essence somehow? A wayward gene? Or just the consequences of a malnourished world? And what about Kyle, Ruby's son? How did one explain what he was going through? I leaned back in my chair thinking about him. Kyle had just turned 16. The 2 years since my arrival had given him several inches, added bulk, the shadow above his upper lip, first efforts at a mustache. He was still polite to me, still willing to talk about the Bulls. "This would be the year Jordan took him to the finals," he said. But he was usually gone whenever I stopped by, or on his way out with friends. Some nights, Ruby would call me at home just to talk about him, how she never knew where he was anymore, how his grades had continued to drop in school, how he hid things from her, the door of his room always closed. "Don't worry," I would tell her. "I was a lot worse at Kyle's age." I don't think she believed that particular truth, but hearing the words seemed to make her feel better. One day, I volunteered to sound Kyle out, inviting him to join me for a pickup basketball game at the University of Chicago gym. Kyle was quiet most of the ride up to Hyde Park, fending off questions with a grunt or a shrug. I asked him if he was still thinking about the Air Force, and he shook his head. He'd stay in Chicago, he said, find a job and get his own place. I asked him what had changed his mind. He said that the Air Force would never let a black man fly a plane. I looked at him crossly. Who told you that mess? Kyle shrugged. Don't need somebody to tell me that. Just is, that's all. Man, that's the wrong attitude, Kyle. You can do whatever you want if you're just willing to work for it. Kyle smirked and turned his head toward the window, his breath misting the glass. Yeah, well, how many black pilots do you know? The gym wasn't crowded when we arrived, and we had to wait only one game before we got onto the court. It had been at least 6 months since I'd even seen a basketball, and the cigarettes had taken their toll. On the first play of the game, the man guarding me stripped the ball clean out of my hands and I called a foul, causing the players on the sidelines to hoot with derision. By the second game, I was walking across the half-court line, feeling slightly dizzy. To spare myself further embarrassment, I decided to sit out the third game and watch Kyle play. His game wasn't bad, but he was guarding a man a few years older than me, an orderly at a hospital, short but aggressive and very quick. After a few plays, it became clear that the man had Kyle's number. He scored 3 baskets in a row, then started talking the usual talk. You can't do no better than that, boy. How you gonna let an old man like me make you look so bad? Kyle didn't answer, but the play between them became rough. The next time down the floor, as the man made his move for the basket, Kyle bumped him hard. The man threw the ball at Kyle's chest, then turned to one of his partners. You see that? This punk can't guard me. Suddenly, without any warning, Kyle swung. His fist landed square on the man's jaw, dropping him to the floor. I ran onto the court as the other players pulled Kyle away. His eyes were wide, his voice trembling as he watched the orderly struggle to his feet and spit out a wad of blood. I ain't no punk, Kyle muttered. And then again, I ain't no punk. We were lucky. Somebody had called the security guard downstairs, but the orderly was too embarrassed to admit to the incident. On the drive back, I gave Kyle a long lecture about keeping his cool, about violence, about responsibility. My words sounded trite, and Kyle sat without answering, his eyes fixed on the road. When I was finished, he turned to me and said, "Just don't tell my mama, all right?" I thought that was a good sign. I said I wouldn't tell Ruby what happened, so long as he did, and he grudgingly agreed. Kyle was a good kid, I thought. He still cared about something. But would that be enough to save him? Well past midnight, a car pulls up in front of my apartment building carrying a troop of teenage boys and a set of stereo speakers so loud that the floor of my apartment begins to shake. I've learned to ignore such disturbances. Where else do they have to go, I say to myself. But on this particular evening, I have someone staying over. I know that my neighbors next door have just brought home their newborn child, and so I pull on some shorts and head downstairs for a chat with our nighttime visitors. As I approach the car, the voices stop. The heads within all turn my way. Listen, I say, people are trying to sleep around here. Why don't y'all just take it someplace else? The 4 boys inside say nothing, don't even move. The wind wipes away my drowsiness, and I suddenly feel exposed, standing in a pair of shorts on the sidewalk in the middle of the night. I can't see the faces inside the car. It's too dark to know how old they are, whether they're sober or drunk, good boys or bad. One of them could be Kyle. One of them could be Johnny. One of them could be me. Standing there, I try to remember the days when I would have been sitting in a car like that, full of inarticulate resentments and desperate to prove my place in the world. The feelings of righteous anger as I shout at Gramps for some forgotten reason. The blood rush of a high school brawl. The swagger that carries me into a classroom, drunk or high, knowing that my teachers will smell beer or reefer on my breath, just daring them to say something. I start picturing myself through the eyes of these boys, a figure of random authority, and know the calculations they might now be making. That if one of them can't take me out, the 4 of them certainly can. That knotted, howling assertion of self, as I try to pierce the darkness and read the shadowed faces inside the car, I'm thinking that while these boys may be weaker or stronger than I was at their age, the only difference that matters is this. The world in which I spent those difficult times was far more forgiving. These boys have no margin for error. If they carry guns, those guns will offer them no protection from that truth. And it is that truth a truth that they surely sense but can't admit, and in fact must refuse if they are to wake up tomorrow, that has forced them, or others like them, eventually to shut off access to any empathy they might once have felt. Their unruly maleness will not be contained, as mine finally was, by a sense of sadness at an older man's injured pride. Their anger won't be checked by the intimation of danger that would come upon me when I split another boy's lip or race down a highway with gin clouding my head. As I stand there, I find myself thinking that somewhere down the line both guilt and empathy speak to our own buried sense that an order of some sort is required, not the social order that exists necessarily, but something more fundamental and more demanding. A sense, further, that one has a stake in this order, a wish that, no matter how fluid this order sometimes appears, it will not drain out of the universe. I suspect that these boys will have to search long and hard for that order, indeed any order that includes them as more than objects of fear or derision. And that suspicion terrifies me, for I now have a place in the world, a job, a schedule to follow. As much as I might tell myself otherwise, we are breaking apart, these boys and me, into different tribes, speaking a different tongue, living by a different code. The engine starts, and the car screeches away. I turn back toward my apartment, knowing that I've been both stupid and lucky, knowing that I am afraid after all. It was an old building in one of the South Side's older neighborhoods, still sound, but badly in need of tuck pointing and perhaps a new roof. The sanctuary was dark, with several pews that had cracked and splintered. The reddish carpet gave off a musty, damp odor, and at various points the floorboards beneath bucked and dipped like welts in a meadow. Reverend Phillips' office had this same chipped, worn quality, lit only by an antique desk lamp that cast the room in a dull amber glow. And Reverend Phillips himself, he was old. With the window shades drawn, surrounded by stacks of dusty old books, he seemed now to be receding into the wall, as still as a portrait, only his snow-white hair clearly visible, his voice sonorous and disembodied, like the voice of a dream. We had been talking for close to an hour, mostly about the church. Not his church so much as the church, the historically black church, the church as an institution, the church as an idea. He was an erudite man, and began our conversation with a history of slave religion, telling me about the Africans who, newly landed on hostile shores, had sat circled around a fire, mixing newfound myths with ancient rhythms, their songs becoming a vessel for those most radical of ideas, survival and freedom and hope. The Reverend went on to recall the Southern Church of his own youth, a small, whitewashed wooden place, he said, built with sweat and pennies saved from sharecropping, where on bright, hot Sunday mornings, all the quiet terror and open wounds of the week drained away in tears and shouts of gratitude, the clapping, waving, fanning hands reddening the embers of those same stubborn ideas, survival and freedom and hope. He discussed Martin Luther King's visit to Chicago and the jealousy he had witnessed among some of King's fellow ministers, their fears of being usurped, and the emergence of the Muslims, whose anger Reverend Phillips understood. It was his own anger, he said, an anger that he didn't expect he would ever entirely escape, but that, through prayer, he had learned to control, and that he had tried not to pass down to his children. Now he was explaining the history of churches in Chicago. There were thousands of them, and it seemed as if he knew them all, the tiny storefronts and the large stone edifices, the high yellow congregations that sat stiff as cadets as they sang from their stern hymnals, and the charismatics who shook as their bodies expelled God's unintelligible tongue. Most of the larger churches in Chicago had been a blend of these two forms, Reverend Phillips explained, an example of segregation's hidden blessings, the way it forced the lawyer and the doctor to live and worship right next to the maid and the laborer. Like a great pumping heart, the church had circulated goods, information, values, and ideas back and forth and back again between rich and poor, learned and unlearned, sinner and saved. He wasn't sure, he said, how much longer his church would continue to serve that function. Most of his better-off members had moved away to tidier neighborhoods, suburban life. They still drove back every Sunday, out of loyalty or habit, but the nature of their involvement had changed. They hesitated to volunteer for anything, a tutoring program, a home visitation, that might keep them in the city after dark. They wanted more security around the church, a fenced-in parking lot to protect their cars. Reverend Phillips expected that once he passed on, many of those members would stop coming back. They would start new churches, tidy like their new streets. He feared that the link to the past would finally be broken, that the children would no longer retain the memory of that first circle, around a fire. Reverend Phillips' voice began to trail off. I felt he was getting tired. I asked him for an introduction to other pastors who might be interested in organizing, and he mentioned a few names. There was a dynamic young pastor, he said, a Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ, who might be worth talking to. His message seemed to appeal to young people like me. Reverend Phillips gave me his number, and as I got up to leave, I said, "If we could just bring 50 churches together, Reverend, we might be able to reverse some of the trends you've been talking about." Reverend Phillips nodded and said, "You might be right, Mr. Obama. You have some interesting ideas. But you see, the churches around here are used to doing things their own way. Sometimes the congregations even more than the pastors." He opened the door for me, then paused. "By the way, what church do you belong to?"
I attend different services."
"But you're not a member anywhere."
"Still searching, I guess."
"Well, I can understand that. It might help your mission if you had a church home, though. It doesn't matter where, really. What you're asking from pastors requires us to set aside some of our more priestly concerns in favor of prophecy. That requires a good deal of faith on our part. It makes us want to know just where you're getting yours from. Faith, that is." Outside, I put on my sunglasses and walked past a group of older men who had set out their lawn chairs on the sidewalk for a game of bid whist. It was a gorgeous day, 75 in late September. Instead of driving straight to my next appointment, I decided to linger, letting my legs hang out the open car door, watching the old men play their game. They didn't talk much, these men. They reminded me of the men Gramps used to play bridge with, the same thick, stiff hands, the same thin socks and improbably slender shoes, the same beads of sweat along the folds of their necks, just beneath their flat caps. I tried to remember the names of those men back in Hawaii, what they had done for a living, wondering what residue of themselves they had left in me. They had been mysteries to me then, those old black men. That mystery was part of what had brought me to Chicago. And now that I was leaving Chicago, I wondered if I understood them any better than before. I hadn't told anyone except Johnny about my decision. I figured there would be time for an announcement later. I wouldn't even hear back from the law schools until January. Our new youth program would be up and running by then. I would have raised next year's budget, hopefully brought in a few more churches. I had told Johnny only because I needed to know whether he'd be willing to stay on and take my place as lead organizer, and maybe too because he was my friend, and I needed to explain myself. Except Johnny hadn't seen the need for explanations. The minute I told him the law schools to which I had applied, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, he had grinned and slapped me on the back.
"I knew it," he shouted.
"Knew what?"
"That it was just a matter of time, Barack, before you were out of here."
"Why do you think that?" Johnny shook his head and laughed.
"Damn, Barack, 'cause you got options, that's why. 'Cause you can leave. I mean, I know you're a conscientious brother and all that. But when somebody's got a choice between Harvard and Roseland, it's only so long somebody's gonna keep on choosing Roseland."
Again, Johnny shook his head.
"Harvard, goddamn. I just hope you remember your friends when you're up in that fancy office downtown."
For some reason, Johnny's laughter had made me defensive. I insisted that I'd be coming back to the neighborhood. I told him that I didn't plan on being dazzled by the wealth and power that Harvard represented, and that he shouldn't be either. Johnny put his hands up in mock surrender.
"Hey, you don't need to be telling me all this. I ain't the one going nowhere."
I grew quiet, embarrassed by my outburst. "Yeah, well, I'm just saying that I'll be back, Johnny, that's all. I don't want you or the leaders to get the wrong idea." Johnny smiled gently.
"Ain't nobody gonna get the wrong idea, Barack. Man, we're just proud to see you succeed.
The sun was now slipping behind a cloud. A couple of the old card players pulled on the windbreakers they had hung on the back of their chairs. I lit a cigarette and tried to decipher that conversation with Johnny. Had he doubted my intentions? Or was it just me that mistrusted myself? It seemed like I'd gone over my decision at least 100 times. I needed a break, that was for sure. I wanted to go to Kenya. Alma was already back in Nairobi, teaching at a university for a year. It would be an ideal time for an extended visit. And I had things to learn in law school, things I thought would help me bring about real change. I would learn about interest rates, corporate mergers, the legislative process, about the way businesses and banks were put together, how real estate ventures succeeded or failed. I would learn power's currency in all its intricacy and detail, knowledge that would have compromised me before coming to Chicago, but that I could now bring back to where it was needed. Bring it back like Promethean fire. That's the story I'd been telling myself, the same story I imagined my father telling himself 28 years before, as he had boarded the plane to America, the land of dreams. He too had probably believed he was acting out of some grand design, that he wasn't simply fleeing from possible inconsequence. And in fact, he had returned to Kenya, hadn't he? But only as a divided man, his plans, his dreams, soon turned to dust. Would the same thing happen to me? Maybe Johnny was right. Maybe once you stripped away the rationalizations, it always came down to a simple matter of escape. An escape from poverty, or boredom, or crime, or the shackles of your skin. Maybe by going to law school, I'd be repeating a pattern that had been set in motion centuries before. The moment white men, themselves spurred on by their own fears of inconsequence, had landed on Africa's shores, bringing with them their guns and blind hunger to drag away the conquered in chains. That first encounter had redrawn the map of black life, recentered its universe, created the very idea of escape, an idea that lived on in Alma, torn between Germany and Kenya, and here, in the South Side, among members of Reverend Phillips' church, some of whom had probably marched alongside Dr. King, believing then that they marched for a higher purpose, for rights and for principles, and for all God's children, but who at some point had realized that power was unyielding and principles unstable, and that even after laws were passed and lynching ceased, the closest thing to freedom would still involve escape, emotional if not physical, away from ourselves, away from what we knew, flight into the outer reaches of the white man's empire, or closer into its bosom. The analogies weren't exactly right. The relationship between black and white, the meaning of escape, would never be quite the same for me as it had been for the old man. As segregated as Chicago was, as strained as race relations were, the success of the civil rights movement had at least created some overlap between communities, more room to maneuver for people like me. I could work in the black community as an organizer or a lawyer and still live in a high-rise downtown. Or the other way around, I could work in a blue-chip law firm, but live in the South Side and buy a big house and drive a nice car, make my donations to the NAACP and Herald's campaign, speak at local high schools. A role model, they'd call me, an example of black male success. Was there anything wrong with that? Johnny obviously didn't think so. He had smiled, I realized now, not because he judged me, but precisely because he didn't, because he, like my leaders, didn't see anything wrong with such success. That was one of the lessons I'd learned these past 2.5 years, wasn't it? That most black folks weren't like the father of my dreams, the man in my mother's stories, full of high-blown ideals and quick to pass judgment. They were more like my stepfather, Lolo, practical people who knew that life was too hard to judge each other's choices, too messy to live according to abstract ideals. No one expected self-sacrifices from me. Not Rafik, who of late had been pestering me about helping him raise some money from white foundations for his latest scheme. As far as they were concerned, my color had always been a sufficient criteria for community membership. Enough of a cross to bear. Was that all that had brought me to Chicago, I wondered? The desire for such simple acceptance. That had been part of it, certainly. One meaning to community. But there had been another meaning, too, a more demanding impulse. Sure, you could be black and still not give a damn about what happened in poor neighborhoods. You didn't have to care about boys like Kyle. But to be right with yourself, to do right by others, to lend meaning to a community's suffering and take part in its healing, that required something more. It required faith. I glanced up now at the small, second-story window of the church, imagining the old pastor inside, drafting a sermon for the week. "Where did your faith come from?" he had asked. It suddenly occurred to me that I didn't have an answer. Perhaps, still, I had faith in myself. But faith in oneself was never enough. With Johnny handling the organization's day-to-day activities, I met with more black ministers in the area, hoping to convince them to join the Developing Communities Project. It was a slow process, for unlike their Catholic counterparts, most black pastors were fiercely independent, secure in their congregations, and with little obvious need for outside assistance. Whenever I first reached them on the phone, they would often be suspicious or evasive, uncertain as to why this young man with a Muslim name wanted a few minutes of their time. And a handful I met with conformed to the prototypes found in Richard Wright novels or Malcolm X speeches, sanctimonious graybeards preaching pie in the sky, or slick holy rollers with flashy cars and a constant eye on the collection plate. For the most part, though, once I'd had a chance to meet these men face to face, I would come away impressed. As a group, they turned out to be thoughtful, hard-working men with a confidence, a certainty of purpose that made them by far the best organizers in the neighborhood. They were generous with their time, interested in the issues, surprisingly willing to open themselves to my scrutiny. One minister talked about a former gambling addiction. Another told me about his years as a successful executive and a secret drunk. They all mentioned periods of religious doubt, the corruption of the world and their own hearts, the striking bottom and shattering of pride, and then finally the resurrection of self, a self alloyed to something larger. That was the source of their confidence, they insisted, their personal fall, their subsequent redemption. It was what gave them the authority to preach the good news. Had I heard the good news, some of them would ask me, do you know where it is that your faith is coming from? When I asked for other pastors to talk to, several gave me the name of Reverend Wright, the same minister Reverend Phillips had mentioned that day at his church. Younger ministers seemed to regard Reverend Wright as a mentor of sorts, his church a model for what they themselves hoped to accomplish. So, toward the end of October, I finally got a chance to pay Reverend Wright a visit and see the church for myself. It sat flush on 95th Street, in a mostly residential neighborhood, a few blocks down from the Loudoun Homes housing project. I had expected something imposing, but it turned out to be a low, modest structure of red brick and angular windows, landscaped with evergreens and sculpted shrubs, and a small sign spiked into the grass. Free South Africa, written in simple block letters. Inside, the church was cool and murmured with activity. A group of small children waited to be picked up from daycare. A crew of teenage girls passed by, dressed for what looked like an African dance class. Four elderly women emerged from the sanctuary, and one of them shouted, "God is good," causing the others to respond giddily, "All the time." Eventually, I was led into Reverend Wright's office. He was in his late 40s, with silver hair, a silver mustache and goatee. He was dressed in a gray three-piece suit. "Sorry for being late, Barack," he said, closing the door behind him. "We're trying to build a new sanctuary, and I had to meet with the bankers. I'm telling you, Doc, they always want something else from you. Latest thing is another life insurance policy on me, in case I drop dead tomorrow. They figure the whole church will collapse without me." "Is it true?" I asked. Reverend Wright shook his head. "I'm not the church, Barack. If I die tomorrow, I hope the congregation will give me a decent burial. I like to think a few tears will be shed. But as soon as I'm 6 feet under, they'll be right back on the case, figuring out how to make this church live up to its mission." He had grown up in Philadelphia, the son of a Baptist minister. He had resisted his father's vocation at first, joining the Marines out of college, dabbling with liquor, Islam, and black nationalism in the 60s. But the call of his faith had apparently remained, a steady tug on his heart. Eventually, he had entered Howard, then the University of Chicago, where he spent 6 years studying for a PhD in the history of religion. He learned Hebrew and Greek, read the literature of Tillich, and Niebuhr, and the black liberation theologians. The anger and humor of the streets, the book learning and occasional 25-cent words, all this he had brought with him to Trinity almost 2 decades ago. And although it was only later that I would learn much of this biography, it became clear in that very first meeting that, despite the Reverend's frequent disclaimers, it was this capacious talent of his, this ability to hold together, if not reconcile, the conflicting strains of black experience, upon which Trinity's success had ultimately been built. "We've got a lot of different personalities here," he told me. "Got the Africanist over here, the traditionalist over here. Once in a while, I have to stick my hand in the pot, smooth things over, before stuff gets ugly. But that's rare. Usually, if somebody's got an idea for a new ministry, I just tell them to run with it and get out of their way." Reverend Wright's approach had obviously worked. The church had grown from 200 to 4,000 members during his tenure. There were organizations for every taste, from yoga classes to Caribbean clubs. He was especially pleased with the church's progress in getting more men involved, although he admitted that they still had a long way to go. "Nothing's harder than reaching young brothers like yourself," Reverend Wright said. "They worry about looking soft. They worry about what their buddies are going to say about them. They tell themselves church is a woman's thing, that it's a sign of weakness for a man to admit that he's got spiritual needs." A secretary interrupted, reminding Reverend Wright of his next appointment. We shook hands, and he agreed to have his assistant prepare a list of members for me to meet. Afterward, in the parking lot, I sat in my car and thumbed through a silver brochure that I'd picked up in the reception area. It contained a set of guiding principles, a black value system, it said, that the congregation had adopted in 1979. At the top of the list was a commitment to God, who will give us the strength to give up prayerful pacifism and become black Christian activists, soldiers for black freedom and the dignity of all humankind. Then a commitment to black community and black family, education, the work ethic, discipline, and self-respect. A sensible, heartfelt list, not so different, I suspected, from the values old Reverend Phillips might have learned in his whitewashed country church 2 generations before. There was one particular passage, though, in Trinity's brochure that stood out. A commandment more self-conscious in its tone, requiring greater elaboration. "A disavowal of the pursuit of middle-classness," the heading read. "While it is permissible to chase middle-incomeness with all our might," the text stated, "those blessed with the talent or good fortune to achieve success in the American mainstream must avoid the psychological entrapment of black middle-classness that hypnotizes the successful brother or sister into believing they are better than the rest and teaches them to think in terms of we and they instead of us." My thoughts would often return to that declaration in the weeks that followed, as I met with various members of Trinity. I decided that Reverend Wright was at least partly justified in dismissing critics who called Trinity a, quote, bougie church. The bulk of its membership was solidly working class, the same teachers and secretaries and government workers one found in other big black churches throughout the city. Residents from the nearby housing projects had been actively recruited, and programs designed to meet the needs of the poor, legal aid, tutorials, drug programs, took up a substantial amount of the church's resources. Still, there was no denying that the church had a disproportionate number of black professionals in its ranks: engineers, doctors, accountants, and corporate managers. Some of them had been raised in Trinity. Others had transferred in from other denominations. Many confessed to a long absence from any religious practice, a conscious choice for some, part of a political or intellectual awakening, but more often because church had seemed irrelevant to them as they'd pursued careers in largely white institutions. At some point, though, they all told me of having reached a spiritual dead end, a feeling at once inchoate and oppressive, that they'd been cut off from themselves. Intermittently, then more regularly, they had returned to the church, finding in Trinity some of the same things every religion hopes to offer its converts: a spiritual harbor, and the chance to see one's gifts appreciated and acknowledged in a way that a paycheck never can. An assurance, as bones stiffened and hair began to gray, that they belonged to something that would outlast their own lives, and that, when their time finally came, a community would be there to remember. But not all of what these people sought was strictly religious, I thought. It wasn't just Jesus they were coming home to. It occurred to me that Trinity, with its African themes, its emphasis on black history, continued the role that Reverend Phillips had described earlier, as a redistributor of values and circulator of ideas. Only now, the redistribution didn't run in just a single direction, from the schoolteacher or the physician, who saw it as their Christian duty to help the sharecropper or young man fresh from the South adapt to big city life. The flow of culture now ran in reverse as well. The former gangbanger, the teenage mother, had their own forms of validation, claims of greater deprivation, and hence authenticity, their presence in the church providing the lawyer or doctor with an education from the streets. By widening its doors to allow all who would enter, a church like Trinity assured its members that their fates remained inseparably bound, that an intelligible us still remained. It was a powerful program, this cultural community, one more pliant than simple nationalism, more sustaining than my own brand of organizing. Still, I couldn't help wondering whether it would be enough to keep more people from leaving the city or young men out of jail. Would the Christian fellowship between a black school administrator, say, and a black school parent change the way schools were run? Would the interest in maintaining such unity allow Reverend Wright to take a forceful stand on the latest proposals to reform public housing? And if men like Reverend Wright failed to take a stand, if churches like Trinity refused to engage with real power and risk genuine conflict, then what chance would there be of holding the larger community intact? Sometimes I would put such questions to the people I met. They would respond with the same bemused look Reverend Phillips and Reverend Wright had given me. For them, the principles of Trinity's brochure were articles of faith, no less than the belief in the resurrection. "You have some good ideas," they would tell me. "Maybe if you join the church, you could help us start a community program. Why don't you come by on Sunday?" And I would shrug and play the question off, unable to confess that I could no longer distinguish between faith and mere folly, between faith and simple endurance. That while I believed in the sincerity I heard in their voices, I remained a reluctant skeptic, doubtful of my own motives, wary of expedient conversion, having too many quarrels with God to accept a salvation too easily won. The day before Thanksgiving, Harold Washington died. It occurred without warning. Only a few months earlier, Harold had won re-election, handily beating his white opponents, breaking the deadlock that had prevailed in the city for the previous 4 years. He had run a cautious campaign this time out, professionally managed, without any of the fervor of 1983, a campaign of consolidation, of balanced budgets and public works. He reached out to some of the old-time machine politicians, the Irish in the polls, ready to make peace. The business community sent him their checks, resigned to his presence. So secure was Harold in his power that rumblings of discontent had finally surfaced within his own base, among black nationalists upset at his willingness to cut whites and Hispanics into the action, among activists disappointed with his failure to tackle poverty head-on, and among people who preferred the dream to the reality, impotence to compromise. Harold didn't pay such critics much attention. He saw no reason to take any big risks, no reason to hurry. He said he'd be mayor for the next 20 years. And then death. Sudden. Simple. Final. Almost ridiculous in its ordinariness. The heart of an overweight man giving way. It rained that weekend, cold and steady. In the neighborhood, the streets were silent. Indoors and outside, people cried. The black radio stations replayed Harold's speeches hour after hour, trying to summon the dead. At City Hall, the lines wound around several blocks as mourners visited the body, lying in state. Everywhere, black people appeared dazed, stricken, uncertain of direction, frightened of the future. By the time of the funeral, Washington loyalists had worked through the initial shock. They began to meet, regroup, trying to decide on a strategy for maintaining control, trying to select Harold's rightful heir. But it was too late for that. There was no political organization in place, no clearly defined principles to follow. The entire of black politics had centered on one man, who radiated like the sun. Now that he was gone, no one could agree on what that presence had meant. The loyalists squabbled, factions emerged, rumors flew. By Monday, the day the city council was to select a new mayor to serve until the special election, The coalition that had first put Harold in office was all but extinguished. I went down to City Hall that evening to watch the second death. People, mostly black, had been gathered outside the city council's chambers since late afternoon. Old people, curiosity seekers, men and women with banners and signs. They shouted at the black alderman who had cut deals with the white bloc. They waved dollar bills at the soft-spoken black alderman, a holdover from machine days, behind whom the white alderman had thrown their support. They called this man a sellout and an Uncle Tom. They chanted and stomped and swore never to leave. But power was patient and knew what it wanted. Power could outwait slogans and prayers and candlelight vigils. Around midnight, just before the council got around to taking a vote, the door of the chambers opened briefly, and I saw two aldermen off in a huddle. One, black, had been Harold's man. The other, white, Verdoliak's. They whispered now, smiling briefly, then looking out at the still chanting crowds and quickly suppressing their smiles. Large, fleshy men in double-breasted suits, with the same look of hunger in their eyes. Men who knew the score. I left after that. I pushed through the crowds that overflowed into the street and began walking across Daly Plaza toward my car. The wind whipped up, cold and sharp as a blade, and I watched a handmade sign tumble past me. "His spirit lives on," the sign read in heavy block letters. And beneath the words, that picture I had seen so many times while waiting for a chair in Smitty's barbershop. The handsome, grizzled face, the indulgent smile, the twinkling eyes, now blowing across the empty space, as easily as an autumn leaf.